Sunday we were looking at Philippians 2, 5 through 8, and the whole business about having the attitude of Christ, and that's our goal, to have an attitude like Jesus. And what was that attitude? Well, the attitude was that he emptied himself. And that statement, emptied himself, brings up a lot of questions. Because the first thing you ask yourself is, what did he empty himself of? And there's a lot of different opinions about that. There is a historical opinion about that, which I want us to see tonight. But let's look at the text again and dive a little deeper into some of these questions. Because I think as we dive into the questions, the harder questions of theology or of a biblical text, it's not just to satisfy our curiosity. It's not just to give us some puffed up feeling of that we know something or to win an argument with somebody. That's certainly not it. It is to know God better, to know what he has revealed about himself. Because when we know God, the knowledge of God, then we are growing spiritually. We are more able to worship this God that we know better. We are more able to appreciate and love him and see the glory of God in who he is. So that's what the purpose of this is. And I hope that that's what we're going to see. So starting in verse 5 again, of Philippians 2, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped or held on to, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And do you remember what the Greek word is for cross? Crux. It was actually a word that people didn't want to say. It works out this way. It was like a four-letter word. You know, I mean, it was a four-letter word, but it was a word that people, it was crass. It was something a proper person that lived in Rome would kind of not tend to talk about. Jesus, the Son of God, leaves heaven to die on a crux from the highest place to the lowest place. And so we kind of spent some time there Sunday, just kind of mulled over that, meditated on it, held out there long enough. And I will say that I'm very encouraged by the response, by the church's response to that. There's kind of a, not because I'm saying it, but because it's just what we're doing, there's kind of a, wow. In fact, that was one person's response, just wow, you know, and that's the right response, by the way. And so when we read a text like this, there are some questions that come into this description, and one of them is, what does it mean that he emptied himself? Now, I answered that partially Sunday, but I'd like to kind of go back over that, because I really think this is really critical, and it also will help us avoid some misunderstandings that could lead us down some paths that has led other people down that's not good. So there's a double benefit. So we avoid the wrong path, but we get to really see the right path of Jesus emptying himself. And so the question we asked Sunday was, did Jesus empty himself of God? If you already believe that Jesus is part of the Godhead and he is God, he's been God in eternity past, what happened when he actually became a man? What happened when the incarnation took place? Well, Philippians 2 tells us that it was that he emptied himself. And for 1,800 years, the church has not believed that he did empty himself of being God, that he emptied himself from being God. But let me give you really the first reason I believe he did not empty himself of God. Which I believe is the true teaching, that he did not empty himself of God. I want to be clear about that. And then we're going to look at the heresy that is quite prevalent today. So why do we believe that he didn't empty himself of God? Why do we believe that he was God? As I'm talking about as orthodox historical beliefs, this is what we believe. As we said Sunday, the text itself kind of answers, not kind of, it answers the question really of what he emptied himself of. It's right there in the text. And the first place you look for interpretation is in the context of when something is explained. You look right there in the verse. That's your first place. You don't just rip a phrase out of the Bible, and then, of course, you see that it's confirmed by the rest of the teaching of the Bible to make sure that it's in the context of the whole Bible to be understood properly. And I think the text does answer the question. It says, he emptied himself, what? Read the next thing. Taking the form of a bondservant. You see how it kind of explains it? He emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant. It doesn't say emptied himself and took the form of a bondservant. It explains what that means. So, and then really the rest of the next verse of verse 8 kind of expands on that. So he takes the form, how did he empty himself? Took the form of a bondservant. He made himself in the likeness of man. He found himself in appearance of man. He humbled himself by coming obedient to the point of death. All of these things are coloring in our understanding of emptied himself. He emptied himself, based on the text, by becoming a bondservant, being made in the likeness of men. Nothing about not being who he was, and he humbled himself in obedience to the point of the cross. So there's your definition. That's what the text says. So let us consider how Jesus was still God, even though he was a man who emptied himself, not of his deity, but of his place, his station, the expression and the display and the privilege of his glory is really what we're talking about. When you think about Jesus being still God, even though he was a man, that's true, right? He didn't stop being God. He still could do miracles at will. He knew what people were thinking without them telling him. So he had an omniscience around him. He raised himself from the dead. Think about that. If you're going to take the position that Jesus stopped being God when he became a man, you got to answer the question, well, then how did he raise himself? You said, did Jesus raise himself from the dead? Well, let's look at that. I want us to take a little time with that because I think this is not only an explanation for seeing Jesus as God, but you see the whole Godhead together on this issue of raising Jesus from the dead. In fact, as I'm going to show you in a second, if you've never seen this before, who raised Jesus from the dead? We would say God did, right? Well, let's see. John chapter 2, starting in verse 18, the Jews then said to him, what sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I will raise it up. The Jews then said, it took 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? Now look at the next verse. But he was speaking of the temple of his body. He's speaking of the temple of his own body. And what did he say about this temple? Tear it down, and who will raise it back up? I will. He said, I will. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remember that he said this. And they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken about the fact that his body not just would be raised, but that he would raise it up. If you go down to verse 23, it says, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name, observing his signs which he was doing. But Jesus on his part was not entrusting himself to them, for he knew all men. And because he did not need anyone to testify concerning man, for he knew himself what was in man. And the implication of that verse is that he knew what was in all men. What does that sound like? Omniscience. So he has these, not just in eternity past, not just in his resurrected state and his glorified state, while he's on the earth, he's exhibiting these attributes that can only be attributed to God. Now go back to the idea of him raising himself from the dead. You say, how could he raise himself from the dead if he was dead? I don't know. I don't know. I'm reading the Bible. There's a lot of things about God I don't know, and I don't understand how he could do something. But it's a matter of what does the Bible teach. Romans 8:11 says this, but if the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, now who raised Jesus from the dead according to this? The spirit. He who raised Christ from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies through his spirit who dwells in you. So apparently, The Spirit of God raised Jesus from the dead. Romans 6:4. Therefore, we have been buried with him through baptism into death, so that as Christ was raised through the glory of the Father. So it was the glory of the Father that raised Jesus from the dead. The Father. So we too might walk in newness of life. So far we've got Jesus raising himself from the dead. We have the Spirit raising him from the dead. And the glory of the Father, which we will equate the glory of God, is God. The Father raises Jesus from the dead. It's all summed up in many verses that say things like this. Acts 5:30, the God of our fathers raised up Jesus. Who did? The God of our fathers. Acts 10:40, God raised him up on the third day and granted that he become visible. Acts 13:30, God raised him from the dead. So, from a biblical point of view, Jesus was able, as man, as the God-man, to perform this incredible miracle. Clearly did not empty himself of being God. So very clearly, every member of the Trinity was involved or raised Jesus from the dead. Jesus was indeed God. Now, I've made that point a lot. I think we need to keep saying it. We need to be very clear about that because it really is important for our understanding of who Christ is. Otherwise, we will just get mixed in with all the other religions in our minds about the nature of our leader. We're not talking about just a smart guy. We're talking about God. He emptied himself. Now, emptied himself then cannot mean that he emptied himself of his godness, of his nature as God, because he claimed God's name even while he was a man. That's another reason why I don't think that he emptied himself of being God. John 8:56, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees, and he saw it and he was glad. So the Jews said to him, you're not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. I am. Therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. They knew what he meant. He was claiming to be God. It was one of the few places where he really brought this out. Remember, we said Sunday, he wasn't going around making this case. He was ready to go to the cross, but he never denied being God. In fact, when pressed, he affirmed it. John 10, the Jews picked up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, I showed you many good works from the Father. From which of them are you stoning me? The Jews answered him, for a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy. And they understood exactly what he meant. Remember, you always look at what the people who were closest to the situation understood someone to mean to get your cue of what they meant. And because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God. They did not misunderstand. And then later in the same text, he says in verse 38, he says, but if I do them, these works, though you do not believe me, believe the works so that you may know and understand. Here it is. The Father is in me and I am in the Father. So the idea that Jesus emptied himself of being God just doesn't jive with so many scriptures. And because of these passages and other ones like them, emptied himself could not mean that he was emptying himself of the attributes of God. And I said Sunday, the point of the passage, you know, in Philippians 2 is to what? To be like Christ, to have the attitude of Christ. And so that means you've got to empty yourself. It's not just to see what Jesus did. The whole point is have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who emptied himself. So you have to empty yourself. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that if you empty yourself, does that mean you're going to stop being you? Does that mean you're going to stop having your abilities and your gifts and your talents? And are you going to cease being you? Even are you going to get rid of your nature? No. You know what that means. If I say to you, come on, let's empty ourselves for these people over here. Let's empty ourselves for the cause of Christ. What are we saying? We're saying, get off your high horse and be willing to go down and be a servant. That's what that means. Not changing your nature. And so actually what makes this all the more powerful is that Jesus did not empty himself of being God and yet still became a servant. Think about that. If you take the position that he didn't empty himself of being God, what does that tell you about this idea of being a servant? He didn't stop being God to be a servant. It would be something quite different for him to release himself of being God and only be a man and then become a servant. That would almost make sense, but that is not the same universe as God remaining God and becoming a servant. You see the difference? And we could go on and on. Jesus' attributes of deity, and maybe the most important that he had, one of the things he did that revealed this to us, is that he received worship. When somebody worshiped him, he did not tell them to stop. And if anybody was receiving worship who was not God, that would be blasphemy. But Jesus never denied anyone worshiping him. He received worship. And when people worshiped him, he gladly received it. Now, if there was ever a time to reveal his true identity, I think that would be it, right? If he was only a man, if he had divested himself of being God, there was his chance to set the record straight when someone worshiped. But not once, not ever did he do that. So the conclusion is, in many, many passages, Jesus is either called God or has the attributes of God, and they're given to him, they're attributed to him. He carries the names of God, which would not be given to him if he wasn't God, if he had divested himself of God. So passages are all over the Bible. But there's really two. They're short, but they're very explicit. I mean, they just say it so clearly. And it's in Colossians chapter 1, verse 29, verse 19, and then Colossians 2, 9. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness. How much of the fullness? All the fullness to dwell in him. The fullness of God. And then in Colossians 2, 8, see to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. And what kind of captive philosophy should you be avoiding? Ones that deal with the very nature of Christ. It's very important. We can't be wrong about this. Why? For in him, all the fullness of deity dwells in what kind of form? Bodily form. When Jesus took on flesh, the body of a man, he did not cease being God. In fact, all the fullness of deity dwelled in bodily form. And John said, we have seen his glory, glory in his only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. We could keep going on that. Let me give you one verse from the Old Testament. It's actually quoted in Matthew 1, verse 23. He's quoting Isaiah 7, 14. You're very familiar with this. We quote it at Christmas time all the time. And it says this, behold the virgin, talking about the Messiah, behold the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means what? God with us. Okay? We know that verse. Now that wasn't his given name. What was his given name? Jesus, right? Jesus. That was the name given to him. And that's been a little confusing for people at times, but he was also given descriptive names. Not just one. Emmanuel was one of them, which is describing him, God with us. And there's many examples of that, even in your life, in your world. You have your kids have names, but sometimes you have a name you give them that's descriptive of them. One of the pastors that I like to read is Martin Lloyd-Jones. He's long since been with the Lord, but Martin Lloyd-Jones was a famous pastor in England. And he was a medical doctor before he became a pastor. And at times, he was known affectionately as the doctor. The doctor. Why? Because he was a doctor. He was a doctor. He was called a doctor. Jesus was known as Emmanuel, which means God with us. Because he was God with us. So his name reflects that. And that's not hard to understand. So we're building this comfortableness with the idea that God did not remove, Jesus did not remove his deity as he became a man. So what about this other teaching that has come up in the last 200 years? It's called, some call it the kenotic theory, okay? And it comes from the Greek word kenosis. It's a biblical word, and it's the word for emptied, okay? And it's called the kenotic theory. And then the meaning is basically, if you hear kenotic theory, there's different versions of it. Some are a little more raw than others. Some are more radical than others. But basically the meaning is this, is that Jesus emptied himself of his divine attributes or even his deity in the strongest uses of this, what I would call a heresy. Now, in the softer versions of it, people sometimes actually use the word kenosis or kenotic theory to describe their understanding that maybe Jesus didn't lose his attributes, but he gave up some of them and not all of them. And so you got to be a little careful with that. It doesn't mean that somebody's not a Christian because maybe they've been affected by some of this. But it does mean there's something to be concerned about here, because when you start removing the nature of God from God, you're in trouble. So let's talk a little bit about this kenotic theology, because it tends to find its way in some strange places. And this is, I think, a good example of a heresy teaching that likes to jump on one word or a phrase or maybe a whole verse, in this case a Greek word, and then they just kind of keep repeating that word and to give it kind of a ring of authority. It's the kenosis. It's the kenosis. And so you hear that, and you start to think, yeah, it's the kenosis. And there's this kind of like manipulative kind of teaching that kind of affects people with that. So let me give you some examples of that. We love her. The big problem with this view is that one of those theologies is based on a few, if not only one verse. And in this case, as I said, one word. So the teacher comes along and they start talking about emptied himself. And that means, and they'll say, that means emptied himself of his attributes. Kenosis. And the unsuspecting person who's not maybe thinking deeply about this or just kind of trusting the teacher on television or in certain churches, they go, oh, wow, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Wow. Really? But then if you were to ask, can you demonstrate that in the Bible, Mr. Bible teacher? He would have to say, well, no, because that's the only verse they've got. There's only one text that speaks of Jesus as emptying himself. And something I think this important, if that was the case, would be taught all over the Bible. But it's not. In fact, it's not anywhere. Now, what do you make then of places where it does seem like Jesus was maybe not omniscient? He didn't know something. Because that's one of the first questions you would ask. What about where it seems like Jesus didn't seem to know? Or that he had to learn something, even as a child? That's a fair question, and one I think we need to address. And obviously there's a mystery that if anyone says that they've kind of locked that down, they probably need to be locked up, because that would be pretty irrational if they got all that figured out. But anyway, what about where he does not seem to exhibit the powers of God as God at certain times where you might? And clearly he has the power to temporarily limit his power if he chooses to, his omniscience or whatever. Is that a mysterious relationship between the Father and the Son? Or is that some loss of his being? Well, let's look at a verse. One of them that comes up is Mark 13, verse 31. Jesus said, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But of that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone." Something the Son does not know. Now, this can be hard to understand if we think about it, but on the other hand, it might not be hard to understand if you accept that God has the ability and the wisdom to do whatever suits his purposes, including choosing to not know something. Now, when I say that, I need to be very careful in saying it, because I don't believe God can ever cease his attributes. He might shade them. He might not insist on the display of them, but he doesn't cease having them, because he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. But Jesus, as we know, had two natures. He's God and he's man. He's God and he's man. And if you think about it in those terms, it can be helpful with this kind of thinking. So the best way, I think, to understand this mystery is that as man, and he was man, remember, we've made that case very strongly, he can't die for the sins of people. Okay, so the best way to understand this is to realize that as a man, he's self-limited, so that when he was a child, did he really have to learn something, or was that all just fake? No, as a human being, he had to learn. He chose to come into the world as a baby. The baby had to grow up. The baby had to learn how to walk. Do you think Jesus was just inside going, all right, watch this act I'll put on for them. You know, I'll just have to act like a baby. I don't think that's what was going on. I think as man, he was really learning how to walk. He was really learning how to talk. Now, that's a mystery, I understand. But that's, if you think about it in terms of as man, that's what he's doing. Similar idea is that Jesus could do any miracle he wanted as God, but he chose not to in order to fully experience being a man. He could have destroyed the devil out in the wilderness when he was being tempted. He could have been gone, but he chose not to. One pastor, Carlton Wynn, said it this way. I think he said it quite well. Let me just read what he said. He said, he became man 2 millennia ago by assuming to himself a true body and a reasonable soul. Now, that came right out of the Westminster Larger Catechism. He assumed a true body, it wasn't like an illusion, and a reasonable soul. He had to think. He had to feel. He had emotions. Both of which, the true body and the reasonable soul, both of which are capable of change. Now and forever, two completely different natures, divine and human, are united in the one Son of God. As a man, then, the Son increased in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man, as man. And like any human being, after the fall, he became hungry, Matthew 4. He grew tired, John 4. He felt distress, Matthew 26. And yes, he was amazed at what he learned, Matthew 8 and Luke 7, Mark 6 and Luke 2. Jesus could have only experienced such changes in his human nature. Could have saved himself from the cross, but he chose not to. But when he did want to be omnipotent against the natural world, he was able to do it. The miracles that he did, that's what God does. The reading of minds, the omniscience, he was able to do that as God. He was able to foretell the future. How was he able to do that? Not as man, but as God. And, you know, if you listen to some people talk about this, it's really crazy. They'll say, he was so intelligent, he was so smart, he was able to portray somebody who could figure out the future by just watching people's human nature. He was that good as a man. Oh, come on. He was God. Luke Stamps, a California Baptist University professor, said it this way. For we know that in Christ the two natures were united into one person in such a manner that each retained its own properties, and more especially the divine nature was in a state of repose and did not at all exert itself whenever it was necessary that the human nature should act separately. I'm going to explain that in a second. According to what was peculiar to itself in discharging the office of mediator. Now, some of that is a quote from John Calvin, because even the reformers were talking about this in great detail. These were important questions even, you know, all these 500 years ago. So when he says there would be no impropriety, therefore, in saying that Christ, who knew all things, was ignorant of something in respect to of perception as a man. For otherwise, he could not have been liable to grief and anxiety, and he could not have been like us. If he wasn't really susceptible to the stresses of human life, which included not knowing things, how could he really be one of us? How could we really say he understands? How could he really have died for our sins? And he says, notice that for Calvin, the Son does not surrender his divine attributes in order to become a human being. Instead, each nature, God and man, retained its own properties, he said. To be sure, during Jesus' earthly ministry, his divinity was in repose. In other words, it was hidden. Or as in the Latin version of Calvin's commentary puts it, the divine nature was kept, as it were, concealed. That is, did not display its power. But the divine nature was not lost or even turned off, so to speak. Because some people say, well, he kind of went back and forth. He was man sometimes, he was God sometimes, he was man sometimes. It wasn't like that. During Jesus' earthly ministry, he was not turning himself on and off. Instead, it was hidden or concealed. And thus, Calvin suggests a cryptic Christology from the Greek word krypsis, concealing, rather than a kenotic Christology. Remember what we said, the emptying himself of his divinity. And obviously, you can look up things like that and read about him, but I want you to have a context for where it's coming from. So in his divinity, Christ knows all things, but in his humanity, Christ was limited in knowledge. Attributes from each of the two natures. I think it would be wise for us to go back to something that was said at the American Gospel video that we watched, because I think they addressed this very well, and they showed how this is very relevant to our culture today. This is not just something from 200 years ago. This is still being taught today in some pretty prominent circles. Before I show you that, I'm going to end with the video. I want to read something from another theologian named Millard Erickson. Because if this is making your head spin a little bit, and I'm not great at explaining it, listen to this, because I think it really helps. It is also helpful, Erickson says, to think of Jesus as a very complex person. Of the people whom he knew, people that we know, some are relatively simple. That is not a reference to their level of intelligence, but rather to the straightforwardness of their personality. One comes to know them fairly quickly, and they may therefore be predictable. Other persons, on the other hand, have much more complex personalities. They may have a wider range of experience, a more varied educational background, or more complex emotional makeup. There are many facets to their personalities, and when we think we know them quite well, another dimension of their lives appears, a dimension which we did not previously know existed. Some of you are saying, I'm married to somebody like that. Now, if we imagine complexity expanded, listen to this. Now, if we imagine complexity expanded to an infinite degree, then we have a bit of a glimpse into the personality of Jesus, as it were, his two natures in one person. For Jesus' personality included the qualities and attributes which constitute deity. There were within his personal dimensions of experience, knowledge, and love that are not found in human beings. And to be sure, this is a problem here, for these qualities differ from the human, not merely in degree, but in kind. And this point serves to remind us that the person of Jesus was not simply an amalgam of human and divine qualities merged into some sort of concoction. Rather, his was a personality that, in addition to the characteristics of divine nature, had all the qualities of attributes of a perfect, sinless human nature as well. That helps me.